Saturday afternoons are terrible in a boys' school, especially in the winter. There is no football game. It is not possible, as it is in the spring, to take bike trips into the surrounding countryside. Not even the most grinding student can feel required to lose himself in his books, since there is Sunday ahead, long, lazy, quiet Sunday, to do any homework. But these Saturdays are worst in the late winter, when the snow has lost its novelty and its shine, and the school seems to have been reduced to only a network of drains. During the brief thaw in the early afternoon, there is a dismal gurgling of dirty water seeping down pipes and along gutters, a gray, seamy shifting beneath the crust of snow, which cracks to show patches of frozen mud beneath. Shrubbery loses its bright snow headgear and stands bare and frail, too undernourished to hide the drains it was intended to hide. These are the days when, going into any building, you cross a mat of dirt and cinders let in by others before you, thinning and finally trailing off in the corridors. The sky is an empty, hopeless gray and gives the impression that this is its eternal shade. Winter's occupation seems to have conquered, overrun, and destroyed everything, so that now there is no longer any resistance movement left in nature. All the juices are dead, every sprig of vitality snapped, and now winter itself, an old, corrupt, tired conqueror, loosens its grip on the desolation, recedes a little, grows careless in its watch. Sick of victory and enfeebled by the absence of challenge, it begins itself to withdraw from the ruined countryside. The drains alone are active, and on these Saturdays, their noises sound a dull recessional to winter. Only Phineas failed to see what was so depressing. Just as there was no war in his philosophy, there was also no dreary weather. As I have said, all weathers delighted Phineas. "You know what we better do next Saturday?" he began in one of his voices, the low-pitched and even melodic one, which for some reason always reminded me of a Rolls-Royce moving along a highway. "We'd better organize the winter carnival." We were sitting in our room on either side of the single large window framing a square of featureless gray sky. Phineas was resting his cast, which was a considerably smaller one now, on the desk and thoughtfully pressing designs into it with a pocket knife. "What winter carnival?" I asked. "The winter carnival. The Devon Winter Carnival. There isn't any Devon Winter Carnival, and never has been." "There is now. We'll have it at that park next to the Neguamsett. The main attraction will be sports, naturally, featuring, I expect, a ski jump." "A ski jump? That park is as flat as a pancake." "And some slalom races, and I think a little track. But we've got to have some snow statues, too, and a little music, and something to eat. Now, which committee do you want to head?" I gave him a wintry smile. "The Snow Statues Committee." "I knew you would. You always were secretly arty, weren't you? I'll organize the sports. Brinker can handle the music and food. And then we need somebody to kind of beautify the place. A few holly wreaths and something like that. Someone good with plants and shrubbery. I know. Leper." From looking at the star he was imprinting in his cast, I looked quickly up at his face. "Leper's gone." "Oh yeah, so he is. Leper would be gone. Well, somebody else then." And because it was Finney's idea, it happened as he said, although not as easily as some of his earlier inspirations. For our dormitory was less enthusiastic about almost everything with each succeeding week. Brinker, for example, had begun a long, decisive sequence of withdrawals from school activity ever since the morning I deserted his enlistment plan. He had not resented my change of heart. In fact, had immediately undergone one himself. If he could not enlist, and for all his self-sufficiency, Brinker could not do much without company. He could at least cease to be so multifariously civilian. So he resigned the presidency of the Golden Fleece Debating Society, stopped writing his school spirit column for the newspaper, dropped the chairmanship of the underprivileged local children's subcommittee of the Good Samaritan Confraternity, stilled his baritone in the chapel choir, and even, in his most impressive burst of irresponsibility, resigned from the Student Advisory Committee to the headmaster's discretionary benevolent fund. His well-bred clothes had disappeared. These days he wore khaki pants, supported by a garrison belt, and boots which rattled when he walked.
"Who wants a winter carnival?"
he said in the disillusioned way he had lately developed when I brought it up.
"What are we supposed to be celebrating?"
"Winter, I guess."
"Winter?"
He gazed out of his window at the vacant sky and seeping ground.
"Frankly, I don't see anything to celebrate. Winter or spring or anything else."
"This is the first time Finney's gotten going on anything since..." he came back.
"He has been kind of non-functional, hasn't he? He isn't brooding, is he?"
"No, he wouldn't brood."
"No, I don't suppose he would. Well, if you think it's something Finney really wants... Still, there's never been a winter carnival here. I think there's probably a rule against it."
"I see," I said in a tone which made Brinker raise his eyes and lock them with mine. In that plotter's glance, all his doubts vanished, for Brinker the lawgiver had turned rebel for the duration. The Saturday was battleship gray. Throughout the morning, equipment for the winter carnival had been spirited out of the dormitory and down to the small, incomplete public park on the bank of the Neguamsett River. Brinker supervised the transfer, rattling up and down the stairwell and giving orders. He made me think of a pirate captain disposing of the booty. Several jugs of very hard cider, which he had browbeaten away from some lower classman, were the most cautiously guarded treasure. They were buried in the snow near a clump of evergreens in the center of the park, and Brinker stationed his roommate, Brownie Perkins, to guard them with his life. He meant this literally, and Brownie knew it. So he trembled alone there in the middle of the park for hours, wondering what would happen if he had an attack of appendicitis, unnerved by thoughts of a fainting spell, horrified by the realization that he might have to move his bowels, until at last we came. Then Brownie crept back to the dormitory, too exhausted to enjoy the carnival at all. On this day of high illegal competitiveness, no one noticed. The buried cider was half-consciously plotted at the hub of the carnival. Around it sprang up large, sloppy statues, easily modeled because of the snow's dampness. Nearby, entirely out of place in this snowscape, like a dowager in a saloon, there was a heavy, circular classroom table, carried there by superhuman exertions the night before on Finney's insistence that we had to have something to display the prizes on. On it rested the prizes. Finney's icebox, hidden all these months in the dormitory basement. A Webster's Collegiate Dictionary with all the most stimulating words marked. A set of York barbells. The Iliad, with English translation of each sentence written above it. Brinker's file of Betty Grable photographs. A lock of hair, cut under duress from the head of Hazel Brewster, the professional town belle. A hand-woven rope ladder, with a proviso that it should be awarded to someone occupying a room on the third floor or higher. A forged draft registration card. And $4.13 from the headmaster's discretionary benevolent fund. Brinker placed this last prize on the table with such silent dignity that we all thought it was better not to ask any questions about it. Phineas sat behind the table in a heavily carved black walnut chair. The arms ended in two lion's heads, and the legs ended in paws gripping wheels now sunk in the snow. He had made the purchase that morning. Phineas bought things only on impulse and only when he had the money, and since the two states rarely coincided, his purchases were few and strange. Chet Douglas stood next to him, holding his trumpet. Finney had regretfully given up the plan of inviting the school band to supply music, since it would have spread news of our carnival to every corner of the campus. Chet, in any case, was an improvement over that cacophony. He was a slim, fair-skinned boy with a ball of curly auburn hair curving over his forehead, and he devoted himself to playing two things, tennis and the trumpet. He did both with such easy inborn skill that after observing him, I began to think that I could master either one any weekend I tried. Much like the rest of us, on the surface, he had an underlying obliging and considerate strain, which barred him from being a really important member of the class. You had to be rude at least sometimes, and edgy often, to be credited with personality, and without that accolade, no one at Devon could be anyone. No one, with the exception, of course, of Phineas. To the left of the prize table, Brinker straddled his cache of cider. Behind him was the clump of evergreens. Behind them there was, after all, a gentle rise where the ski jump committee was pounding snow into a little takeoff ramp, whose lip was perhaps a foot higher than the slope of the rise. From there, our line of snow statues, unrecognizable artistic attacks on the headmaster, Mr. Ludsbury, Mr. Patch Withers, Dr. Stanpole, the new dietitian, and Hazel Brewster, curved in an enclosing half-circle to the icy, muddy, lisping edge of the tidewater Neguamset and back to the other side of the prize table. When the ski jump was ready, there was a certain amount of milling around. 20 boys, tightly reined in all winter, stood now as though with the bit firmly clamped between their teeth, ready to stampede. Phineas should have started the sports events, but he was absorbed in cataloging the prizes. All eyes swung next upon Brinker. He had been holding a pose above his cider of Gibraltar invulnerability. He continued to gaze challengingly around him until he began to realize that wherever he looked, calculating eyes looked back.
All right," he said roughly. "Let's get started."
The ragged circle around him moved perceptibly closer.
"Let's get going," he yelled. "Come on, Finny, what's first?"
Phineas had one of those minds which could record what was happening in the background and do nothing about it because something else was preoccupying him. He seemed to sink deeper into his list.
"Phineas!"
Brinker pronounced his name with the maximum use of teeth.
"What is next?"
Still, the sleek brown head bent mesmerized over the list. "What's the big hurry, Brinker?" someone from the tightening circle asked with dangerous gentleness. "What's the big rush?"
"We can't stand here all day," he blurted. "We've got to get started if we're going to have this damn thing. What's next? Phineas!"
At last, the recording in Finney's mind reached its climax. He looked vaguely up, studied the straddling at-bay figure of Brinker at the core of the poised perimeter of boys, hesitated, blinked, and then, in his organ voice, said good-naturedly, "Next?" "Well, that's pretty clear." "You are." Chet released from his trumpet the opening, lifting, barbaric call of a bullfight, and the circle of boys broke wildly over Brinker. He flailed back against the evergreens, and the jugs appeared to spring out of the snow.
"What the hell?"
he kept yelling, off balance among the branches.
"What the hell?"
By then, his cider, which he had apparently expected to dole out according to his own governing whim, was disappearing. There was going to be no government, even by whim, even by Brinker's whim, on this Saturday at Devon. From a scramble of contenders, I got one of the jugs, elbowed off a counterattack, opened it, sampled it, choked, and then went through with my original plan by stopping Brinker's mouth with it. His eyes bulged and blood vessels in his throat began to pulsate until, at length, I lowered the jug. He gave me a long, pondering look, his face closed and concentrating, while behind it his mind plainly teetered between fury and hilarity. I think if I had batted an eye, he would have hit me. The carnival's breaking apart into a riot hung like a bomb between us. I kept on looking, expressionlessly, back at him until, beneath a blackening scowl, his mouth opened enough to fire out the words,
"I've been violated!"
I jerked the jug to my mouth and took a large gulp of cider in relief, and the violence latent in the day drifted away. Perhaps the Neguamset carried it out on the receding tide. Brinker strode through the swirl of boys to Phineas.
"I formally declare," he bellowed, "that these games are open."
"You can't do that," Phineas said rebukingly. Who ever heard of opening the games without the sacred fire from Olympus?
Sensing that I must act as the chorus, I registered on my face the universally unheard-of quality of the games without fire. Fire! Fire! I said across the damp snow.
We'll sacrifice one of the prizes, said Phineas, seizing the Iliad.
He sprinkled the pages with cider to make them more inflammable, touched a match to them, and a little jet of flame curled upward. The games, alight with Homer and cider, were open. Chet Douglas, leaning against the side of the prize table, continued to blow musical figures for his own enlightenment. Forgetful of us and the athletic programming Finney now put into motion, he strolled here and there, sometimes at the start of the ski jump competition, blowing an appropriate call, more often invoking the serene order of Haydn, or a high, remote, arrogant Spanish world, or the cheerful, low-down carelessness of New Orleans. The hard cider began to take charge of us. Or I wonder now whether it wasn't the cider, but our own exuberance which intoxicated us, sent restraint flying, causing Brinker to throw the football block on the statue of the headmaster, giving me, as I put on the skis and slid down the small slope, and off the miniature ski jump, a sensation of soaring flight, of hurtling high and far through space, inspiring Phineas, during one of Chet's Spanish inventions, to climb onto the prize table and with only one leg to create a droll dance among the prizes, springing and spinning from one bare space to another, cleanly missing Hazel Brewster's hair, never marring by a misstep the pictures of Betty Grable. Under the influence not, I know, of the hardest cider, but of his own inner joy of life, for a moment as it should be, as it was meant to be in his nature, Phineas recaptured that magic gift for existing primarily in space, one foot conceding briefly to gravity its rights before spinning him off again into the air. It was his wildest demonstration of himself in the kind of world he loved. It was his choreography of peace. And when he stopped and sat down among the prizes and said,
"And now we're going to have the decathlon. Quiet, everybody! Our Olympic candidate, Gene Forrester, is now going to qualify."
It wasn't the cider which made me in this moment champion of everything he ordered, to run as though I were the abstraction of speed, to walk the half circle of statues on my hands, to balance on my head, on top of the icebox, on top of the prize table. To jump, if he asked it, across the Neguamsit and land crashing in the middle of Quackenbush's boathouse. To accept at the end of it amid a clatter of applause, for on this day even the schoolboy egotism of Devon was conjured away, a wreath made from the evergreen trees which Phineas placed on my head. It wasn't the cider which made me surpass myself. It was this liberation we had torn from the gray encroachments of 1943, the escape we had concocted, this afternoon of momentary, illusory, special, and separate peace. And it was this which caused me not to notice Brownie Perkins rejoin us from the dormitory, and not to hear what he was saying until Finney cried hilariously,
"A telegram for Gene! It's the Olympic Committee! They want you! Of course they want you! Give it to me, Brownie! I'll read it aloud to this assembled host!"
And it was this which drained away as I watched Finney's face pass through all the gradations between uproariousness and shock. I took the telegram from Phineas, facing in advance whatever the destruction was. That was what I learned to do that winter.
"I have escaped and need help. I'm at Christmas location. You understand? No need to risk address here. My safety depends on you coming at once. Signed, your best friend, Elwin Leper Lepelier."
Chapter 10. That night I made for the first time the kind of journey which later became the monotonous routine of my life, traveling through an unknown countryside from one unknown settlement to another. The next year, this became the dominant activity, or rather passivity, of my army career. Not fighting, not marching, but this kind of nighttime ricochet. For as it turned out, I never got to the war. I went into uniform at the time when our enemies began to recede so fast that there had to be a hurried telescoping of military training plans. Programs scheduled to culminate in 2 years became outmoded in 6 months, and crowds of men gathered for them in one place were dispersed to 20 others. A new weapon appeared, and those of us who had traveled to 3 or 4 bases mastering the old one were sent on to a 5th, 6th, and 7th to master the new. The closer victory came, the faster we were shuttled around America in pursuit of a role to play in a drama which suddenly, underpopulated from the first, now had too many actors. Or so it seemed. In reality, there would have been, as always, too few. Except that the last act, a mass assault against suicidally defended Japan, never took place. I and my year. Not my generation, for destiny now cut too finely for that old phrase. I and those of my year were preeminently eligible for that. Most of us, so it was estimated, would be killed. But the men a little bit older closed in on the enemy faster than predicted, and then there was the final holocaust of the bomb. It seemed to have saved our lives. So journeys through unknown parts of America became my chief war memory, and I think of the first of them as this nighttime trip to Lepers. There was no question where to find him. "I am at Christmas location" meant that he was at home. He lived far up in Vermont, where at this season of the year even the paved main highways were bumpy and buckling from the freezing weather, and each house executes a lonely holding action against the cold. The natural state of things is coldness, and houses are fragile havens, holdouts in a death landscape, unforgettably comfortable, simple though they are, just because of their warmth. Lepers was one of these hearths perched by itself on a frozen hillside. I reached it in the early morning after this night which presaged my war. A bleak, drafty train ride, a damp depot seemingly near no town whatever, a bus station in which none of the people were fully awake, or seemed clean, or looked as though they had homes anywhere, a bus which passengers entered and left at desolate stopping places in the blackness. A chilled nighttime wandering in which I tried to decipher between lapses into stale sleep the meaning of Leper's telegram. I reached the town at dawn, and encouraged by the returning light and the coffee in a thick white cup, I accepted a hopeful interpretation. Leper had escaped. You didn't escape from the army, so he must have escaped from something else. The most logical thing a soldier escapes from is danger, death, the enemy. Since Leper hadn't been overseas, the enemy must have been in this country. And the only enemies in this country would be spies. Leper had escaped from spies. I seized this conclusion and didn't try to go beyond it. I suppose all our butt-room stories about him intriguing around the world had made me half ready to half believe something like this. I felt a measureless relief when it occurred to me. There was some color, some hope, some life in this war after all. The first friend of mine who ever went into it tangled almost immediately with spies. I began to hope that after all, this wasn't going to be such a bad war. The Lepelier house was not far out of town, I was told. There was no taxi, I was also told. And there was no one, I did not need to be told, who would offer to drive me out there. This was Vermont. But if that meant austerity towards strangers, it also meant mornings of glory such as this one, in which the snow, white almost to blueness, lay like a soft comforter over the hills, and birches and pines indestructibly held their ground, rigid lines against the snow and sky, very thin and very strong, like Vermonters. The sun was the blessing of the morning, the one celebrating element, an aesthete with no purpose except to shed radiance. Everything else was sharp and hard, but this Grecian sun invoked joy from every angularity, and blurred with brightness the stiff face of the countryside. As I walked briskly out the road, the wind knifed at my face, but this sun caressed the back of my neck. The road led out along the side of a ridge, and after a mile or so, I saw the house that must be Lepper's, riding the top of a slope. It was another brittle-looking Vermont house, white, of course, with long and narrow windows, like New England faces. Behind one of them hung a gold star which announced that a son of the house was serving the country, and behind another stood Lepper. Although I was walking straight toward his front door, he beckoned me on several times, and he never took his eyes from me, as though it were they which held me to my course. He was still at this ground floor window when I reached the door, so I opened it myself and stepped into the hallway. Lepper had come to the entrance of the room on the right, the dining room.
"Come in here," he said. "I spend most of my time in here."
As usual, there were no preliminaries. "What do you do that for, Lepper? It's not very comfortable, is it?"
"Well, it's a useful room."
"Yes, I guess it's useful, all right."
"You aren't lost for something to do in dining rooms. It's living rooms where people can't figure out what to do with themselves. People get problems in living rooms."
"Bedrooms, too." It was a try toward relieving the foreboding in his manner. It only worked to deepen it. He turned away, and I followed him into an unfurnished dining room with high back chairs, rugless floor, and cold fireplace. "If you want to be in a really functional room," I began with false heartiness, "you ought to spend your time in the bathroom, then." He looked at me, and I noticed the left side of his upper lip lift once or twice, as though he were about to snarl or cry. Then I realized that this had nothing to do with his mood, that it was involuntary. He sat down at the head of the table in the only chair with arms. His father's chair, I supposed. I took off my coat and sat in a place at the middle of the table, with my back to the fireplace. There, at least, I could look at the sun rejoicing on the snow.
"In here, you never wonder what's going to happen. You know the meals will come in 3 times a day, for instance."
"I bet your mother isn't too pleased when she's trying to get one ready." Force sprang into his expression for the first time.
"What's she got to be pleased about?"
He glared challengingly into my startled face.
"I'm pleasing myself,"
he cried fervently, and I saw tears trembling in his eyes. "Well, she's probably pleased." Any words would serve. The more irrelevant and superficial, the better. Any words which would stop him. I didn't want to see this. "She's probably pleased to have you home again." His face resumed its dull expression. The responsibility for continuing the conversation, since I had forced it to be superficial, was mine.
"How long will you be here?"
He shrugged, a look of disgust with my question crossing his face. The careful politeness he had always had was gone. "Well, if you're on furlough, you must know when you have to be back." I said this in what I thought of at the time as my older voice, a little businesslike and experienced. "The army doesn't give out passes and then say, 'Come back when you've had enough here.'"
"I didn't get any pass," he groaned, with the sliding despair of his face and his clenched hands.
That's what it was, a groan.
"I know you said,"
I spoke in short, expressionless syllables, "that you escaped." I no longer wanted this to be true. I no longer wanted it to be connected with spies or desertion or anything out of the ordinary. I knew it was going to be, and I no longer wanted it to be.
"I escaped,"
the words surging out in a voice and intensity that was not Lepper's. His face was furious, but his eyes denied the fury. Instead, they saw it before them. They were filled with terror.
"What do you mean you escaped?"
I said sharply. "You don't escape from the army."
"That's what you say. That's because you're talking through your hat."
His eyes were furious now, too, glaring blindly at me.
"What do you know about it anyway?"
None of this could have been said by the Leper of the Beaver Dam.
"Well, I... how am I supposed to answer that?"
I know it's normal in the army, that's all.
Normal, he repeated bitterly. What a stupid-ass word that is.
I suppose that's what you've been thinking about, isn't it? That's what you've been thinking about, somebody like you. You're thinking, I'm not normal, aren't you? I can see what you're thinking. I see a lot I never saw before.
His voice fell to a querulous whisper.
You're thinking I'm psycho.
I gathered what the word meant. I hated the sound of it at once. It opened up a world I had not known existed. Mad or crazy or a screw loose, those were familiar words. Psycho had a sudden mental ward reality about it, a systematic, diagnostic sound. It was as though Leper had learned it while in captivity, far from Devon or Vermont or any experience we had in common, as though it were in Japanese. Fear seized my stomach like a cramp. I didn't care what I said to him now. It was myself I was worried about. For if Leper was psycho, it was the army which had done it to him, and I and all of us were on the brink of the army.
You make me sick, you and your damn army words. They were going to give me...
He was almost laughing, everywhere but in his eyes, which continued to oppose all he said.
They were going to give me a discharge, a Section 8 discharge.
As a last defense, I had always taken refuge in scornful superiority, based on nothing. I sank back in the chair, eyebrows up, shoulders shrugging.
I don't even know what you're talking about. You just don't make any sense at all. It's all Japanese to me. A Section 8 discharge is for the nuts in the service, the psychos, the funny farm candidates. Now do you know what I'm talking about? They give you a Section 8 discharge, like a dishonorable discharge, only worse. You can't get a job after that. Everybody wants to see your discharge, and when they see a Section 8, they look at you kind of funny. The kind of expression you've got on your face. Like you were looking at someone with their nose blown off, but don't want them to know that you're disgusted. They look at you that way, and then they say, well, there doesn't seem to be any openings at present. You're screwed for life! That's what a Section 8 discharge means! You don't have to yell at me. There's nothing wrong with my hearing. Then it's tough shit for you, Buster! They've got you! Nobody's got me! Oh, they've got you all right! Don't tell me who's got me and who hasn't got me! Who do you think you're talking to? Stick to your snail's lapelier.
And he began laughing again.
You always were a lord of the manor, weren't you? A swell guy, except when the chips were down. You always were a savage underneath. I always knew that, only I never admitted it. But in the last few weeks...
Despair broke into his face again.
I admitted a hell of a lot to myself. Not about you. Don't flatter yourself. I wasn't thinking about you. Why the hell should I think about you? Did you ever think about me? I thought of myself and Ma and the old man and pleasing them all the time.
Well, never mind about that now. It's you we happen to be talking about now. Like a savage underneath, like...
Now there was a blind confusion in his eyes again, a wild slyness around his mouth.
Like the time you knocked Finney out of the tree. I sprang out of my chair. You stupid, crazy bastard! Still laughing. Like the time you crippled him for life!
I shoved my foot against the rung of the chair and kicked. Leper went over in his chair and collapsed against the floor. Laughing and crying, he lay with his head on the floor and his knees up.
Always were a savage underneath.
Quick heels coming down the stairs, and his mother, large, soft, and gentle-looking, quivered at the entrance.
What on earth happened? Elwin?
I'm terribly... It was a mistake. I listened objectively to my own voice. He said something crazy. I forgot myself. I forgot that he's... There's something the matter with his nerves, isn't there? He didn't know what he was saying.
Well, good heaven, the boy is ill.
We both moved swiftly to help up the chuckling Leper.
Did you come here to abuse him?
I'm terribly sorry, I muttered. I'd better get going. Mrs. Lapellier was helping Leper toward the stairs.
Don't go,
he said between chuckles.
Stay for lunch. You can count on it.
Always 3 meals a day, war or peace in this room.
And I did stay. Sometimes you are too ashamed to leave. That was true now. And sometimes you need too much to know the facts. And so, humbly and stupidly, you stay. That was true now, too. It was an abundant Vermont lunch. More like a dinner. And at first, it had no more reality than a meal in the theater. Leper ate almost nothing, but my own appetite deepened my disgrace. I ate everything within reach, and then had to ask, face aflame with embarrassment, for more to be passed to me. But that led to this hard-to-believe transformation. Mrs. Lepelier began to be reconciled to me, because I liked her cooking. Toward the end of the meal, she became able to speak to me directly, in her high but gentle, modulated voice, and I was so clumsy and fumbling and embarrassed that my behavior throughout lunch amounted to one long, elaborate apology, which, when she offered me a second dessert, I saw she had accepted.
"He's a good boy underneath," she must have thought. "A terrible temper, no self-control, but he's sorry, and he's a good boy underneath."
Leper was closer to the truth. She suggested he and I take a walk after lunch. Leper now seemed all obedience, and except for the fact that he never looked at his mother, the ideal son. So we put on some odds and ends of clothing, some canvas and woolen and flannel pulled on to form a patchwork against the cutting wind, and we trailed out the back door into the splendor of the failing sunshine. I did not have New England in my bones. I was a guest in this country, even though by now a familiar one. I could never see a totally extinguished winter field without thinking it unnatural. I would tramp along, trying to decide whether corn had grown there in the summer, or whether it had been a pasture, or what it could ever have been, in that deep layer of the mind where all is judged by the five senses and primitive expectations. I knew that nothing would ever grow there again. We roamed across one of these wastes, our feet breaking through at each step the thin surface crust of ice into a layer of soft snow underneath. And I waited for Leper, in this wintry outdoors he loved, to come to himself again. Just as I knew the field could never grow again, I knew that Leper could not be wild or bitter or psycho tramping across the hills of Vermont. "Is there an army camp in Vermont?" I asked, so sure in my illusion that I risked even making him talk about the army.
"I don't think there is."
"There ought to be. That's where they should have sent you. Then you wouldn't have gotten nervous." "Yeah," I half chuckle.
"I was what they call nervous in the service."
Exaggerated laughter from me. "Is that what they call it?" Leper didn't bother to make a rejoinder. Before, there had always been his polite capping of remarks like this.
"Yes, they do. That's what they call it."
But today he glanced speculatively at me and said nothing. We walked on, the crust cracking uneasily under us. "Nervous in the service," I said. "That sounds like one of Brinker's poems."
"That bastard."
"Oh, you wouldn't know Brinker these days, the way he's changed."
"I'd know that bastard if he changed into Snow White."
"Well, he hasn't changed into Snow White."
"That's too bad."
The strained laughter was back in his voice.
"Snow White with Brinker's face on her. There's a picture."
Then he broke into sobs.
"Leper, what is it? What's the matter? Leper? Leper!"
Hoarse, cracking sobs broke from him. Another ounce of grief, and he would have begun tearing his country store clothes.
"Leper! Leper!"
This exposure drew us violently together. I was the closest person in the world to him now, and he to me.
"Leper, for God's sakes, leper!"
I was about to cry myself.
"Stop that! Now, just stop! Don't do that! Stop doing that, leper!"
When he became quieter, not less despairing, but too exhausted to keep on, I said,
"I'm sorry I brought up Brinker. I didn't know you hated them so much."
Leper didn't look capable of such hates, especially now, with his rapid plumes of breath puffing out as from a toiling steam engine. His nose and eyes gone red, and his cheeks red too, in large, irregular blotches. Leper had the kind of fragile, fair skin given to high, unhealthy coloring. He was all color, painted at random, but none of it highlighted his grief. Instead of desperate and hate-filled, he looked, with his checkered outfit and blotchy face, like a half-prepared clown.
"I don't really hate Brinker. I don't really hate him, not any more than anybody else."
His swimming eyes cautiously explored me. The wind lifted a sail of snow and billowed it past us.
"It was only..."
He drew in his breath so sharply that it made a whistling sound.
"The idea of his face on a woman's body. That's what made me psycho. Ideas like that. I don't know. I guess they must be right. I guess I am psycho. I guess I must be. I must be. Do you ever have ideas like that?"
"No."
"Would they bother you if you did? If you happened to keep imagining a man's head on a woman's body? Or if sometimes the arm of a chair turned into a human arm if you looked at it too long? Things like that? Would they bother you?"
I didn't say anything.
"Maybe everybody imagines things like that when they're away from home, really far away, for the first time. Do you think so?"
"The camp I went to first, they called it a reception center. Got us up every morning when it was pitch black, and there was food, like the kind we throw out here, and all my clothes were gone, and I got this uniform that didn't even smell familiar. All day I wanted to sleep, after we got to basic training. I kept falling asleep all day long at the lectures we went to, on the firing range, and everywhere else. But not at night. Next to me there was a man who had a cough that sounded like his stomach was going to come up. One of these times it sounded like it would come up through his mouth and land with a splat on the floor. He always faced my way. We did sleep head to foot, but I knew it would land near me. I never slept at night. During the day, I couldn't eat this food that should have been thrown away, so I was always hungry except in the mess hall. The mess hall. The army has the perfect word for everything. Did you ever think of that?"
I imperceptibly nodded and shook my head, yes and no.
"And the perfect word for me,"
he added in a distorted voice, as though his tongue had swollen.
"Psycho! I guess I am. I must be. Am I, though, or is the army? Because they turn everything inside out. I couldn't sleep in bed. I had to sleep everywhere else. I couldn't eat in the mess hall. I had to eat everywhere else. Everything began to be inside out, and the man next to me at night, coughing himself inside out. That was when things began to change. One day, I couldn't make out what was happening to the corporal's face. He kept changing into faces I knew from somewhere else, and then I began to think he looked like me, and then he..."
Leper's voice had thickened unrecognizably.
"He changed into a woman. I was looking at him as close as I'm looking at you, and his face turned into a woman's face, and I started to yell for everybody. I began to yell so that everyone would see it, too. I didn't want to be the only one to see a thing like that. I yelled louder and louder to make sure everyone within the reach of my voice would hear. You can see there wasn't anything crazy in the way I was thinking, can't you? I had good reason for everything I did, didn't I? But I couldn't yell soon enough or loud enough, and when somebody did finally come to me, it was this man with a cough who slept in the next cot, and he was holding a broom because he had been sweeping out the barracks. But I saw right away it wasn't a broom. It was a man's leg which had been cut off. I remember thinking he must have been at the hospital helping with the amputations when he heard my yell. You can see there's logic in that."
The crust beneath us continued to crack. As we reached the border of the field, the frigid trees also were cracking with the cold. The two sharp groups of noises sounded to my ears like rifles being fired in the distance. I said nothing, And Leper, having said so much, went on to say more, to speak above the wind and the cracking, as though his story would never be finished.
Then they grabbed me, and there were arms and legs and heads everywhere, and I couldn't tell when any minute...
Shut up!
Softer, more timidly.
When any minute...
Do you think I want to hear every gory detail? Shut up! I don't care! I don't care what happened to you, Leper! I don't give a damn! Do you understand that? This has nothing to do with me! Nothing at all! I don't care!
I turned around and began a clumsy run across the field in a line which avoided his house and aimed toward the road leading back into the town. I left Leper, telling his story into the wind. He might tell it forever. I didn't care. I didn't want to hear any more of it. I had already heard too much. What did he mean by telling me a story like that? I didn't want to hear any more of it, not now or ever. I didn't care because it had nothing to do with me. And I didn't want to hear any more of it. Ever.
Chapter 11. I wanted to see Phineas, and Phineas only. With him there was no conflict, except between athletes. Something Greek-inspired and Olympian in which victory would go to whoever was the strongest in body and heart. It was the only conflict he ever believed in. When I got back, I found him in the middle of a snowball fight at a place called the Fields Beyond. At Devon, the open ground among the buildings had been given carefully English names. The Center Common, the Far Common, the Fields, and the Fields Beyond. These last were past the gym, the tennis courts, the river, and the stadium, on the edge of the woods, which, however English in name, were in my mind primevally American, reaching in unbroken forests far to the north, to the great northern wilderness. I found Finney beside the woods, playing and fighting. The two were approximately the same thing to him. And I stood there, wondering whether things weren't simpler and better at the northern terminus of these woods, 1,000 miles due north into the wilderness, somewhere deep in the Arctic, where the peninsula of trees which began at Devon would end at last in an untouched grove of pine, austere and beautiful. There is no such grove, I know now. But the morning of my return to Devon, I imagined that it might be just over the visible horizon, or the horizon after that. A few of the fighters paused to yell a greeting at me, but no one broke off to ask about Leper. But I knew it was a mistake for me to stay there. At any moment, someone might. This gathering had obviously been Finney's work. Who else could have inveigled 20 people to the farthest extremity of the school to throw snowballs at each other? I could just picture him at the end of his 10 o'clock class, organizing it with the easy authority which always came into his manner when he had an idea which was particularly preposterous. There they all were now, the cream of the school, the lights and leaders of the senior class, with their high IQs and expensive shoes, as Brinker had said, pasting each other with snowballs. I hesitated on the edge of the fight and the edge of the woods, too tangled in my mind to enter either one or the other. So I glanced at my wristwatch, brought my hand dramatically to my mouth as though remembering something urgent and important, repeated the pantomime in case anybody had missed it, and with this tacit explanation started briskly back toward the center of the school. A snowball caught me on the back of the head. Finney's voice followed it. "You're on our side, even if you do have a lousy aim. We need somebody else, even you." He came toward me, without his cane at the moment, his new walking cast so much smaller and lighter that an ordinary person could have managed it with hardly a limp noticeable. Finney's coordination, however, was such that any slight flaw became obvious. There was an interruption, brief as a drumbeat, in the continuous flow of his walk, as though with each step he forgot for a split second where he was going. "How's Leper?" he asked in an offhand way. "Oh, Leper's... how would he be? You know Leper." The fight was moving toward us. I stalled a little more. A stray snowball caught Finney on the side of the face. He shot one back. I seized some ammunition from the ground, and we were engulfed. Someone knocked me down. I pushed Brinker over a small slope. Someone was trying to tackle me from behind. Everywhere there was the smell of vitality in clothes, the vital something in wool and flannel and corduroy which spring releases. I had forgotten that this exists. This smell which, instead of the first robin or the first bud or leaf, means to me that spring has come. I had always welcomed vitality and energy and warmth radiating from thick and sturdy winter clothes. It made me happy. But I kept wondering about the next spring, about whether khaki or suntans or whatever the uniform of the season was, had this aura of promise in it. I felt fairly sure it didn't. The fight veered. Finney had recruited me and others as allies, so that two sides fighting it out had been taking form. Suddenly, he turned his fire against me. He betrayed several of his other friends. He went over to the others, to Brinker's side, for a short time. Enough to ensure that his betrayal of them would heighten the disorder. Loyalties became hopelessly entangled. No one was going to win or lose after all. Somewhere in the maze, Brinker's sense of generalship disappeared, and he too became as slippery as an Arab, intriguing as a eunuch. We ended the fight the only way possible. All of us turned on Phineas. Slowly, with a steadily widening grin, he was driven down beneath a blizzard of snowballs. When he had surrendered, I bent cheerfully over to help him up, seizing his wrist to stop the final treacherous snowball he had ready, and he remarked, "Well, I guess that takes care of the Hitler Youth outing for one day." All of us laughed. On the way back to the gym, he said, "That was a good fight. I thought it was pretty funny, didn't you?" Hours later, it occurred to me to ask him, "Do you think you ought to get into fights like that? After all, there's your leg. Stanpole said something about not falling again. But I'm very careful." "Christ, don't break it again." "No, of course I won't break it again." "Isn't the bone supposed to be stronger when it grows together over a place where it's been broken once?" "Yes, I think it is." "I think so, too. In fact, I think I can feel it getting stronger." "You think you can? Can you feel it?" "Yes, I think so." "Thank God." "What? I said that's good." "Yes, I guess it is. I guess that's good, all right." After dinner that night, Brinker came into our room to pay us one of his formal calls. Our room had by this time of year the exhausted look of a place where two people had lived too long without taking any interest in their surroundings. Our cots at either end of the room were swayed back beneath their pink and brown cotton spreads. The walls, which were much farther off white than normal, expressed two forgotten interests. Finney had scotch-taped newspaper pictures of the Roosevelt-Churchill meeting above his cot. "They're the two most important of the old men," he had explained, "getting together to make up what to tell us next about the war." Over my cot, I had long ago taped pictures which together amounted to a barefaced lie about my background. Weepingly romantic views of plantation mansions, moss-hung trees by moonlight, lazy roads winding dustily past the cabins of the Negroes. When asked about them, I acquired an accent appropriate to a town three states south of my own, and I had transmitted the impression, without actually stating it, that this was the old family place. But by now I no longer needed this vivid false identity. Now I was acquiring, I felt, a sense of my own real authority and worth. I had had many new experiences, and I was growing up.
"How's Leper?" said Brinker as he came in.
"Yeah," said Phineas. "I meant to ask you before."
"Leper? Why, he's on leave." But my resentment against having to mislead people seemed to be growing stronger every day. As a matter of fact, Leper is absent without leave. He just took off by himself.
"Leper?"
both of them exclaimed together.
Yes,
I shrugged. Leper. Leper's not the little rabbit we used to know anymore.
Nobody can change that much,
said Brinker in his new, tough-minded way.
Finney said, he just didn't like the army, I bet. Why should he? What's the point, anyway?
Phineas, Brinker said with dignity, please don't give us your infantile lecture on world affairs at this time.
And to me, he was too scared to stay, wasn't he? I narrowed my eyes as though thinking hard about that. Finally, I said, yes, I think you can put it that way.
He panicked.
I didn't say anything.
He must be out of his mind, said Brinker energetically. To do a thing like that? I bet he cracked up, didn't he? That's what happened. Leper found out that the army was just too much for him. I've heard about guys like that. Some mornings they don't get out of bed with everyone else. They just lie there, crying. I bet something like that happened to Leper.
He looked at me.
Didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Brinker had closed with such energy, almost enthusiasm on the truth, that I gave it to him without many misgivings. The moment he had it, he crumbled.
Well, I'll be damned. I'll be damned! Old leper. Quiet old leper. Quiet old leper from Vermont. He never could fight worth a damn. You'd think somebody would have realized that when he tried to enlist. Poor old leper. What's he act like?
He cries a lot of the time.
Oh, God. What's the matter with our class anyway? It isn't even June yet, and we've already got two men sidelined for the duration.
Two? Brinker hesitated briefly.
Well, there's Finney here.
Yes,
agreed Phineas in his deepest, most musical tone.
There's me.
Finney isn't out of it,
I said.
Of course he is.
Yes, I'm out of it.
Not that there's anything to be out of.
I wondered if my face matched the heartiness of my voice.
Just this dizzy war, this fake, this thing with the old men making...
I couldn't help watching Finney as I spoke, and so I ran out of momentum. I waited for him to take it up, to unravel once again his tale of plotting statesmen and deluded public, his great joke, his private toehold on the world. He was sitting on his cot, elbows on knees, looking down. He brought his wide-set eyes up. His grin flashed and faded. And then he murmured,
"Sure. There isn't any war."
It was one of the few ironic remarks Phineas ever made, and with it, he quietly brought to a close all his special inventions which had carried us through the winter. Now the facts were re-established, and gone were all the fantasies, such as the Olympic Games for A.D. 1944, closed before they had ever been opened. There was little left at Devon anymore which had not been recruited for the war. The few stray activities and dreamy people not caught up in it were being systematically corralled by Brinker. And every day in chapel, there was some announcement about qualifying for V-12, an officer training program the Navy had set up in many colleges and universities. It sounded very safe, almost like peacetime, almost like just going normally on to college. It was also very popular. Groups the size of LST crews joined it, almost everyone who could qualify, except for a few who wanted to fly, and so chose the Army Air Force, or something called V-5 instead. There were also a special few with energetic fathers who were expecting appointments to Annapolis or West Point or the Coast Guard Academy, or even, this alternative had been unexpectedly stumbled on, the Merchant Marine Academy. Devon was by tradition, and by choice, the most civilian of schools. There was a certain strained hospitality in the way both the faculty and students worked to get along with the leathery recruiting officers who kept appearing on campus. There was no latent snobbery in us.
We didn't find any in them. It was only that we could feel a deep, sincere difference between us and them, a difference which everyone struggled with awkward fortitude to bridge. It was as though Athens and Sparta were trying to establish not just a truce, but an alliance, although we were not as civilized as Athens, and they were not as brave as Sparta. Neither were we. There was no rush to get into the fighting. No one seemed to feel the need to get into the infantry, and only a few were talking about the Marines. The thing to be was careful and self-preserving. It was going to be a long war. Quackenbush, I heard, had two possible appointments to the military academy, with carefully prepared positions in V-12 and dentistry school to fall back on if necessary. I myself took no action. I didn't feel free to. I didn't know why this was so. Brinker, in his accelerated change from absolute to relative virtue, came up with plan after plan, each more insulated from the fighting than the last. But I did nothing. One morning, after a naval officer had turned many heads in chapel with an address on convoy duty, Brinker put his hand on the back of my neck in the vestibule outside and steered me into a room used for piano practice near the entrance. It was soundproofed, and he swung the vault-like door closed behind us. "You've been putting off enlisting in something for only one reason," he said at once. "You know that, don't you?"
"No, I don't know that."
"Well, I know, and I'll tell you what it is. It's Finney. You pity him."
"Pity him?"
"Yes, pity him. And if you don't watch out, he's going to start pitying himself. Nobody ever mentions his leg to him except me. Keep that up, and he'll be sloppy with self-pity any day now. What's everybody beating around the bush for? He's crippled. That's that. He's got to accept it, and unless we start acting perfectly natural about it, even kid him about it once in a while, he never will."
"You're so wrong. I can't even hear you. You're so wrong."
"Well, I'm going to do it anyway."
"No, you're not."
"The hell I'm not. I don't have to have your approval, do I? I'm his roommate, and I'm his best friend." "And you were there when it happened." "I know. And I don't give a damn. And don't forget," he looked at me sharply, "you've got a little personal stake in this. What I mean is that it wouldn't do you any harm, you know, if everything about Finney's accident was cleared up and forgotten."
I felt my face grimacing in the way Finney's did when he was really irritated.
"What do you mean by that?" "I don't know," he shrugged and chuckled in his best manner. "Nobody knows."
Then the charm disappeared, and he added,
"Unless you know."
And his mouth closed in its straight, expressionless line, and that was all that was said. I had no idea what Brinker might say or do. Before, he had always known and done whatever occurred to him because he was certain that whatever occurred to him was right. In the world of the Golden Fleece Debating Society and the Underprivileged Local Children's Subcommittee of the Good Samaritan Confraternity, this had created no problems. But I was afraid of that simple executive directness now. I walked back from chapel and found Finney in our dormitory, blocking the staircase until the others who wanted to go up sang, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," under his direction. No one who was tone-deaf ever loved music so much. I think his shortcoming increased his appreciation. He loved it all, indiscriminately. Beethoven, the latest love ditty, jazz, a hymn. It was all profoundly musical to Phineas.
"Our helper, he amid the floods,"
wafted out across the common in the tempo of a football march,
"of mortal ills prevailing."
"Everything was all right," said Finney at the end. "Phrasing, rhythm, all that. But I'm not sure about your pitch. Half a tone off, I would estimate offhand."
We went on to our room. I sat down at the translation of Caesar I was doing for him, since he had to pass Latin at last this year or fail to graduate. I thought I was doing a pretty good job of it.
Is anything exciting happening now?
This part is pretty interesting, I said, if I understand it right, about a surprise attack.
Read me that.
Well, let's see. It begins, "When Caesar noticed that the enemy was remaining for several days at the camp fortified by a swamp, and by the nature of the terrain, he sent a letter to Trebonius instructing him." Instructing him isn't actually in the text, but it's understood. You know about that.
Sure, go on.
"Instructing him to come as quickly as possible by long forced marches to him." This hymn refers to Caesar, of course. Finney looked at me with glazed interest and said,
"Of course."
"Instructing him to come as quickly as possible by long forced marches to him with 3 legions. He himself," Caesar that is, "sent cavalry to withstand any sudden attacks of the enemy. Now when the Gauls learned what was going on, they scattered a selected band of foot soldiers in ambushes, who, overtaking our horsemen after the leader, Vertiscus, had been killed, followed our disorderly men up to our camp."
I have a feeling that's what Mr. Horn is going to call a muddy translation. What's it mean?
Caesar isn't doing so well.
But he won it in the end.
Sure. If you mean the whole campaign, I broke off. He won it if you really think there was a Gallic War. Caesar, from the first, had been the one historical figure Phineas refused absolutely to believe in. 2,000 years in the past, master of a dead language and a dead empire, the bane and bore of schoolboys, Caesar he believed to be more of a tyrant at Devon than he had ever been in Rome. Phineas felt a personal and sincere grudge against Caesar, and he was outraged most by his conviction that Caesar and Rome and Latin had never been alive at all. "If you really think there ever was a Caesar," I said. Finney got up from the cot, picking up his cane as an afterthought. He looked oddly at me, his face set to burst out laughing, I thought.
"Naturally, I don't believe books, and I don't believe teachers."
He came across a few paces.
"But I do believe. It's important, after all, for me to believe you. Christ, I've got to believe you, at least. I know you better than anybody."
I waited without saying anything.
"And you told me about Leper, that he's gone crazy. That's the word, we might as well admit it. Leper's gone crazy. When I heard that about Leper, then I knew that the war was real. This war and all wars. If a war can drive somebody crazy, then it's real, all right. Oh, I guess I always knew, but I didn't have to admit it."
He perched his foot, small cast with a metal bar across the bottom to walk on, next to where I was sitting on the cot.
"To tell you the truth, I wasn't too completely sure about you when you told me how Leper was. Of course I believed you," he added hurriedly, "but you're the nervous type, you know? And I thought maybe your imagination got a little inflamed up there in Vermont. I thought he might be not quite as mixed up as you made out."
Finney's face tried to prepare me for what came next.
"Then I saw him myself."
I turned incredulously.
"You saw Leper?" "I saw him here this morning after chapel. He was, well, there's nothing inflamed about my imagination. And I saw Leper hiding in the shrubbery next to the chapel. I slipped out the side door, the way I always do, to miss the rush. And I saw Leper, and he must have seen me. He didn't say a damn word. He looked at me like I was a gorilla or something, and then he ducked into Mr. Carhart's office."
"He must be crazy," I said automatically, and then my eyes involuntarily met Finney's. We both broke into sudden laughter.
"We can't do a damn thing about it,"
he said ruefully. "I don't want to see him," I muttered. Then, trying to be more responsible, "Who else knows he's here?"
"No one, I would think."
"There's nothing for us to do. Maybe Carhart or Dr. Stampole can do something." We won't tell anybody about it because they would just scare Leper, and he would scare them.
Anyway, said Finny, then I knew there was a real war on.
Yes, I guess it's a real war, all right.
But I liked yours a lot better.
So did I.
I wish you hadn't found out.
What did you have to find out for? We started to laugh again, with a half-guilty exchange of glances, in the way that two people who had gone on a gigantic binge when they were last together would laugh when they met again at the parson's tea.
Well, he said, you did a beautiful job in the Olympics, and you were the greatest news analyst who ever lived. Do you realize you won every gold medal in every Olympic event? No one's ever done anything like that in history, and you scooped every newspaper in the world on every story!
The sun was doing antics among the million specks of dust hanging between us, and casting a brilliant, unstable pool of light on the floor.
No one has ever done anything like that before!
Brinker and three cohorts came with much commotion into our room at 10:05 p.m. that night.
We're taking you out, he said flatly.
It's after hours, I said. Where?
Said Finny with interest at the same time.
You'll see. Get them.
His friends half lifted us, half roughly, and we were hustled down the stairs. I thought it must be some kind of culminating prank. The senior class leaving Devon with a flourish. Were we going to steal the clapper from the school bell? Or would we tether a cow in chapel? They steered us toward the first building. Burnt down and rebuilt several times, but still known as the first building of the Devon School. It contained only classrooms, so at this hour was perfectly empty, which made us stealthier than ever. Brinker's many keys, surviving from his class officer period, jingled softly as we reached the main door. Above us, in Latin, flowed the inscription, "Here boys come to be made men." The lock turned. We went in, entering the doubtful reality of a hallway familiar only in daylight and bustle. Our footsteps fell guiltily on the marble floor. We continued across the foyer to a dreamlike bank of windows, turned left up a pale flight of marble steps, left again through two doorways and into the assembly room. From the high ceiling, one of the celebrated Devon chandeliers, like glittering tears, scattered thin illumination. Row after row of black early American benches spread emptily back through the shadows to long, vague windows. At the front of the room, there was a raised platform with a balustrade in front of it. About 10 members of the senior class sat on the platform, all of them wearing their black graduation robes. This was going to be some kind of schoolboy masquerade, I thought. Some masquerade with masks and candles.
"You see how Phineas limps?" said Brinker loudly as we walked in.
It was too coarse and too loud. I wanted to hit him for shocking me like that. Phineas looked perplexed.
"Sit down," he went on. "Take a load off your feet."
We sat in the front row of benches, where 8 or 10 others were sitting, smirking uneasily at the students on the platform.